On today's episode of Open Kwong Door, Ken Wolfe.
Okay, it's rolling.
It's rolling, people.
I got nothing. I don't know what to say.
Welcome to Open. Oh, start that one again. Okay.
So tell me about Ken Wolfe.
Well, the reason why I wanted to talk to him, he is my boss at the website at cbcsports.ca. But aside from that, and being a lovely human being.
So after the interview, do you still have your job?
I hope so. But you know what? He has a very interesting story. He was trained as a journalist and has entered this sort of new media kind of age. He was part of the team that launched the websites in 1996 for cbcnews.ca and CBC News World. So from that standpoint, when you think about it, you know, 17 years ago, is that how long it was? Something like that. We weren't where we are today as far as websites and whatever. So I was able to talk to him about, you know, the first big stories and sort of contrasting how stories were covered then, how they're covered now. And of course, the game changers like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all those other social media platforms. So I thought it was really interesting to go to an expert about how journalism and the way stories are reported, how it's changing. You know, you and I are both interested in storytelling. So at what point does the truth and the storytelling, at what point do they intersect? And, you know, how can you, are people massaging the truth in order to gain ratings? I think so. Certainly when I'm watching some of the news coverage on television at different places, especially, you know, south of the border. So sensationalism, where does it stop? Where does the news start? So just interesting.
And also with all these new ways of covering all this stuff, I mean, I get a lot of information or news or what's going on through Twitter and all of that kind of thing. But also you've got to sift through all of the stuff because it's sort of it blows up and then all of a sudden it's sort of like a really worldwide bad game of like broken telephone potentially. And it's, you have to sort of, these media outlets are trying to embrace all of this stuff, but at the same time it's like they're still old-fashioned reporting that has to combine with all of this stuff.
And old-fashioned hard work. And this was what was so interesting about talking to Ken, because he comes up with some very interesting and compelling examples for why we should all be just a tiny bit nervous about what's going on. So I think you're going to like it. So if you want to follow Ken Wolfe and sort of see what's going on and see who he's following, he's on Twitter at Wolfe Ken, and the Wolf has two F's. So Ken Wolfe, journalist extraordinaire, senior producer of cbcsports.ca website.
On this episode, my guest is the senior producer for cbcsports.ca, in charge of the content on the website cbcsports.ca, and on a normal day, and also looking after any special projects like World Cups, Olympics, and any other big sports events that will be featured on the website. This is a position he's held for almost 6 years. Interestingly, as far as the web is concerned, he started the website for CBC News World and launched cbcnews.ca in 1996. Before that, starting in 1980, he began his career at CBC Radio and produced Metro Morning in Toronto and worked on Morningside along with the amazing Peter Zowski. He's also worked as an assignment editor for CBC's The National. Away from CBC, he teaches writing at Sheridan College, has been involved with the Media and Democracy Group for 6 years, I'm going to ask you about that, and has paid his dues as a hockey dad as the president of the Mississauga Terriers for 15 years. You can find him on Twitter at Wolf Ken Wolf with two F's. And he is one of the men I most want to stop and chat with at CBC. Welcome, Ken Wolf. Thank you for talking to me.
Is that me?
That's you. I can't believe it either since I know you.
I certainly don't. Holy smokes. Where'd that all come from?
So tell me, I want to talk about little Ken Wolf. So when you were back when you were a cub.
Yeah.
When did you think of journalism as a career? What was that? When was that moment?
That's a good question. When did I think of journalism?
They're all good questions, Ken.
It's PJ. They've got to be good questions. When I was in grade 13, when we used to have grade 13.
Yep, I was there too.
I actually wanted to be a teacher, and I thought no one would ever hire me as a teacher, so what else should I do? So I said journalism.
Now, why did you think no one would hire you as a teacher?
Those were days actually kind of similar to today, right, when everyone graduates as teachers, but there weren't many jobs.
Oh, I see. It wasn't because of you.
No, it wasn't because of me, because I love the idea of teaching, but it was a real basic, where am I going to get paid from?
And getting paid is something that's certainly really important.
Helps.
Boy, does it ever.
Yeah, helps.
So you graduated from Carleton University in journalism back in the last century. Doesn't that sound dramatic?
Yes, I'm not going to go. Yes.
We all did. Don't worry about it.
Typewriters.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about. Can you paint a picture for me of what a journalism grad, what their bag of tools looked like, what was going on that was sort of cutting edge?
Yeah, I'm gonna tell a Peter Zosky story. Can I start there?
Love
right at
that.
The very beginning?
You're gonna start at the top and we're gonna work down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I agree with you. He was an amazing journalist, an amazing guy. When I worked with him, we used to have what we used to call five-part greens.
Okay.
So we would, in our research, and we would make a lot of phone calls to set up an interview for him. And what we had to do was put all of the information on pieces of paper. We typed it on the typewriter.
Wow.
And there were five parts that you give to the director, you gave to Peter, you gave to other people. So it just gets, you know, with carbon paper in the middle, and you take the carbon out, and then you distribute all of the pieces of paper. Word processing came in.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly you didn't have to do a typewritten page. So if you remember when you typed, you tried to make sure everything you wrote was accurate because you didn't have to want to rip up that piece of paper and start from the very beginning. So we had a story meeting one day, and Peter came out and said, you know, one of the worst things that's ever happened is that you guys are working on word processors. And we said, what are you talking about? And he said, you write so much now that instead of writing five pages, you're writing 10 pages, and it's not nearly as good as it was at five pages.
Wow.
Because what happened is you didn't have to go through as much editing in your head because you didn't have to redo that piece of paper. So you just sat down and started to write. So I think that was quite significant, the way we were thinking about our stories and the information we were giving Peter.
And, you know, it's so interesting because when we're talking about stories, you know, when you read a lot like you do and like I do, there are a lot of people there. I used to talk about people who would talk for the sake of hearing their own voice. They love to hear themselves speak. And I find that sometimes writers, especially bloggers, of which I am one, but they want to see more words as somehow better. So you're right, that idea of editing it down to something that is stronger and better seems to have been a little bit out the window.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think, you know, in my career as teaching writing, that's one of the things I talk about the most is just writing short is hard work. Writing long is easy.
Sure. Talking long is easy.
Yeah.
It's like trying to find a tagline or trying to find something to try. Well, that's, you know what? It's funny. We're going to start where I was going to go way down in this interview. But I want to talk a little bit about that whole idea of social media. So Twitter, I actually love, because I consider it a bit of a challenge to say exactly what you want to say in the 140 characters. So there's that part of writing concisely and clearly so that people know where you're going in 140 characters, which to me is kind of a bit of a jigsaw puzzle. It's a bit of something I do for fun. But I want you to tell me about here at CBC, because you're at the internet is the beast that cannot be satisfied. You know, it's like always the hungry beast as far as I'm concerned. So how do you find social media has changed what you've been doing? That's a big question.
Did you hear that silence?
Okay, so when you and I first met 6 years ago, I was in my second year of writing here.
Yeah.
So there wasn't Twitter, really. Nobody ever considered Facebook as a viable, and it was something that teenagers did. Twitter was like a what? And then all these other, the Tumblr and all the rest of it, you know, the idea of posting video online. I remember the first time that I came to you with that idea of, you know, I'm talking to these people. Wouldn't it be fun to get a couple of questions and have their face? And, you know, we had to have a meeting to decide. We didn't, you did, to have to decide whether or not that was actually taking away a cameraman's job. And when they determined that using a flip cam is not exactly the same thing and does not require the same expertise. I mean, everything has changed, even in the last 6 years. I mean, you started with one thing of people writing for content for the web, and now it's exploded. So how are you keeping on abreast of it? How are you keeping on top of it?
I'm working with a lot of people younger than me.
Do you think that's
the truthful
key?
Answer is that, and no, that obviously I'm surrounded by people who know this really, really well. It's a completely different world of communications. The thought process going into it is different. What people respond to is different. We get numbers every week on the CBC website, and it tells us what stories are the most popular stories and what stories people are reading. 2 weeks ago, the top story was a vote, and it was when Brett Laurie of the Blue Jays exploded, and the question was, should the Blue Jays trade him?
So this was a poll question on the website.
And that was viewed more times than anything else that we did.
Really?
Second viewed was 8 things you should know to watch the next round of the playoffs, okay. Which was just point form.
Yep.
And the written copy, which I'm still in love with and sort of favor, was way down the list. This week it's a little bit different, but I think it's an indication of how people are consuming information in a completely different manner. And as soon as we went, first of all, to the website, I remember, 98, I went to...
Now, you'd already produced 2 websites at that point, for one
well,
for News World?
Well, then we started newsworld.cbc.ca, and then we started cbc.ca. So I went to a course held by the Poynter Institute in Florida, which to me is one of the best training grounds in North America that you can go to. And one of the things that I remember specifically, they were doing iTrack surveys. They still do the iTrack survey, which is simply a way of measuring what people are doing when they're watching a website. And it actually looks to see where your eye is going.
Now, how can they tell?
It's a complicated formula that
okay.
If a lot of people actually, it's really cool because parts that they read show up and parts that they don't read, it's all in black. And at that stage, they were saying, are people actually looking at the copy or are they looking at pictures?
Wow.
And one of the things they discovered is people don't read anymore, they scan.
Mm-hmm.
And that has become even greater now than it was then. And people scan websites. They don't read them. One of your columns. If you write it really, really well, they'll hang in there. But if it gets a little long, they're not reading it with
mm-hmm.
you. That they're just scanning it. They're looking at a headline. They're looking at the first couple words. If they like it, they might read it, but usually it'll go for 4 or 5 paragraphs and that's it. So that whole process means everything is fast and instantaneous, and then you put Twitter into it,
mm-hmm.
which is the ultimate in instantaneous mm-hmm. information, and you get this notion of how consuming information has changed drastically. So if you take, go back to Zosky in those
yep.
days, like we were writing maybe 2,500 word backgrounders for him. That doesn't happen anywhere now for the most part because...
It's 10 points.
Yeah, it's just boom, 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 boom.
Do you think that, so when I look at, when I'm watching interviews and interviewers, I'm realizing that people have to have in their head, and the model that I've tried to use for this podcast is doing a fair amount of research on the person that I'm going to interview, write a whole bunch of questions, and then basically start with a conversation. And if I get stuck, then I've got go-to questions, but I have basically an idea. So I
and
think,
by the way, her questions are on the table.
In
going on the ground pretty soon.
I know. I don't have my reading glasses on, so I can't even see them. But I think that there's much more responsibility now for the interviewer to get it right than there may have been way back when stuff was just being fed to talking heads. You know what I mean?
Well, in many ways, I think the audience is more knowledgeable now.
Yeah, everybody's got access to the information.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Which you didn't before. And there is so much media out there. It's really, this is a unique, interesting format because you actually get to talk to people.
Yes.
But hey, I'll even go back before Zosky days when I produced Metro Morning. I remember in those days I worked on Parliament Street in Toronto and David Peterson, before he was a premier
yeah.
of Ontario, used to live in Cabbage Town and he used to go out jogging in the morning and he'd be in his jogging pants and sweat top and he'd come in and do an interview with Joe. Joe Cote, who was the host of the show.
Sure.
At that stage, politicians actually answered questions.
Mm-hmm. They don't anymore.
Because they hadn't been asked the same question 26 times in the last 2 weeks. So you actually had interviews with politicians that made sense, and they didn't sound like they were canned. Now, in this world of communication, man, they're prepared for everything. I don't know how you break them off, because they've heard everything. They've tried everything. It's been done a million times. So getting that real conversation is very hard. And it's just, this is a really different format that people are coming back to. And it's informal, which doesn't happen that much anymore.
Well, it's very interesting to me. I was talking to Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer. You sent me to Canadians or to Skate Canada. And I asked them an offbeat question about nothing that had to do with skating. And they kind of laughed. They know me anyway. But they laughed. But that set the stage for me to be able to ask the question I really wanted to ask, which was a skating-related question. Had I asked that question first, it would have been, well, you know, we give 110% or whatever. So I find sometimes it's interesting to, as somebody who likes to ask the questions and who likes to interview, it's interesting to try and find that one question that's going to get them a little bit off balance, not in a bad way, but just something that they're a little bit surprised by one way or the other, and then you can get what you want. So I think, again, it comes back to you have to find a way, I think, in today's world, it doesn't matter what you're doing in media, you have to find a way to set yourself apart from everybody else.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And that's the tough part.
Yeah, it's really hard to do that. But this is one of the things you've been able to do, is you're setting yourself apart, because you actually do things like this. And then you actually go and take your own video.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at an event, you tweet, you create you as an individual, which you never used to do as much as
well,
this.
Well, it was considered sort of, I'm not casting any aspersions on myself, but it was considered a little bit unprofessional in a way. So a real journalist, and I'm not a journalist, I consider myself to be a commentator and an opinionator. Ha! I made up that word.
Opinionator.
You
like
that?
Yeah.
You can use it. But I don't consider myself to be a journalist. I had a great podcast with Bev Smith, and we were talking about writing and interviews and whatever, and she said, it's not my job to protect anybody, it's my job to report. And I thought, you know, that's very interesting, and that's probably why I'm not going to ever be a good journalist. Doesn't mean I'm not going to get good stories, but it means I'm not going to set you up as an 18-year-old athlete to say something that's going to embarrass you in perpetuity, although it may make my career for me. I'm not willing to pay that price.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because obviously she's one of the great
journalists
we've had,
absolutely,
especially in figure skating. Like, she knows that world. She's been covering that forever. But man, it's a different world now.
Yeah.
From what she has gone through, because, again, when I teach at Sheridan College, we spend some time trying to figure out what the heck a journalist is.
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone can be a journalist these days. And there's a lot of, I'm in the process of reading a lot of stuff about community and how people access and what is a journalist now. Like, there are people who go through journalism school and they graduate and they have a certain set of skills. But I'm not certain that that's the only the way you become a journalist, because if you set up your own blog, if you start communicating with groups, you can have as much influence as a journalist does.
Well, certainly as much presence.
As much presence. But I think you can have as much influence.
Do you
because
think...
it used to be mass media.
You know,
Marsha McLuhan wrote about mass media. I'm not sure it is mass media anymore. I think it's small group media. So because there are, and actually I was having this conversation with my wife the other day.
Hi, Mrs. Wolf.
Hi, Janet. How are you? A lot of our friends seem to be becoming less generalists than they ever used to be.
Okay.
So I've got a buddy who just, he doesn't watch any modern movies. He watches movies from the 50s and 60s because they're the greatest movies ever. Another friend who just is into making amplifiers and sort of for music, and he has surrounded himself in that world.
Is he single?
No.
Kidding.
Shockingly to me.
There's a long-suffering wife. Bless you.
But it's everybody's creating their own world.
Yeah.
Right? And everyone is becoming a specialist. Whereas, and I'm saying, well, what tap into people who know a little bit about everything, which to me was the definition of being a journalist. I've always said that I know a little bit about almost everything, but I don't know a lot about very many things.
Unless you have to research it for a piece.
Unless you have to research it.
Well, you know, our education, though, reflects that. And that's one of the objections that I have to the current education. I don't want to say back when I was a kid, but back when I was a kid, you know, if you had an arts degree, which is what I have a degree in modern languages, it didn't necessarily mean anything in the sense that I didn't get trained as a teacher or really anything. But what it did was it showed I had a capacity to think and to reason and to take something through to its conclusion. So now when my kids who are, you know, 29, 27, and 22, when they decided to go to school, you had about a 1-inch band of education. So my daughter, who's in information technology management, Bachelor of Commerce, very, very worthwhile degree, but very narrow in its focus. So I'm finding that most of the programs from which kids are exiting are so narrowly focused that they're not easily able to find a job. Now, conversely, employers are not looking for generalists. They're looking for somebody to have that very narrow focus. So it's tough. It goes both ways, I think.
Yeah, and I think a part of that is, one is everyone wants to make money and everyone wants a job, and they think by being an expert in one area they get a job. But I think, I'm not Marshall McLuhan, but the
Still
way...
Cute,
now I am speechless.
Adorable.
The way the media is going now, everyone is just knowing a little bit of information. And part of it is because, like on Twitter, you follow who you want to follow. I follow a lot of athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And people can exist just by following athletes.
Yeah.
And watching Sportsnet. Whereas you used to have a lot of general information that came across. If you read a newspaper, you actually scan headlines about different topics all the time. Not sure the younger generation does that anymore.
Well, they're accessing information on their phones and on iPads and tablets on their way to work. Now, interestingly, when you're talking about headlines, it just occurred to me that supports what we're just talking about, which is you scan the headlines so that you know whether the Boston Bruins won or lost last night. You know whether or not the mayor's in trouble again. You know whether or not there's been a plane crash, but you actually don't know very much more than that. But it's enough to be able to say, hey, did you see that? Yeah, I saw that.
Right.
So what do you tell your students about what is a journalist? Who is a journalist? Who are the journalists today?
Well, I'm probably more general about it than most of the people I teach with. And the people who come to me, I help train them as journalists. But I have a recognition that there are others out there who have journalistic skills. And yes, they don't have the training, which is why you get so many screw-ups on Twitter, because people don't understand you always have to get it right.
Yeah, that's
true.
Which
is a minor thing in journalism.
That whole accuracy thing.
Yeah,
it's
what
overrated.
The heck. Yeah. But I think there's a huge number of people out there who have the skill sets who are acting as journalists, although they don't go through the official training. What that means in the future, I'm not certain. I'm not certainly certain it's good.
So, yeah. So the goal of the website when you first helped launch those two websites, what was the, because the internet, to tell you the truth, we go back 15 years, considered a bit of a joke in a way. Sort of like, yeah, okay, the internet. Nobody ever thought of it as being viable in any way, just that it was sort of a bit of a necessary evil. Now, in many ways, the internet and the information that we're providing on it is ahead of the curve. I mean, you and I have talked about the fact that you can sometimes get a heads up to something that's coming down on Twitter because somebody makes a mention of an injury or of a something, and then you've got something to chase. So tell me about what it was like then. What was the goal of a website then? And then where we're at today with that?
The goal at the very beginning was just another way of providing information.
Okay.
One of the things that I talked about a fair amount there then is that we at CBC, and we started cbcnews.ca, had a bit of an advantage. First of all, we had pictures. So we had the broadcast network. In that, we had audio and video that no one else had. In those days, if you were the Toronto Star website, all you did, in fact, they still do it frequently, which I think is a weakness, is they would just take a print article and put it online. We actually have to write our stories, because if you ever take broadcast copy and try to put it online, then you go, oh my God, what's that? I don't get it, because you don't, it's a different
There's
way
no
of writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, it's different details.
Sure.
You write differently. When you see a television story, it's amazing how much of your reaction is actually emotional rather than dealing with the information. Because if you see the script, you see actually the pictures are telling a lot of the story, not the words. So we actually had to learn how to write for the web, which I don't think anyone else could say. So I think we developed a real skill set on actually the different ways of conveying information through this new technology than the old ways of doing it. You still see, and the Globe and Mail is actually trying to emphasize it in some ways, long-form writing. But sometimes they just put that on the web, to me, which is just a total waste of time.
Well, it's sort of, in some ways, to me, diminishes its values. It's a very old-fashioned way of thinking for me. So rather than having the website front and center or parallel to the paper, it seems to be like, yeah, we'll just throw it away. It's not that important. Now, the other thing that's interesting about the newspaper business, of course, cbc.ca is free. If I want to find out information, I can go to cbc.ca and look at news, sports, whatever I want to do. And it's generalized. I can find out my weather in Toronto. The newspapers haven't quite figured out how they're going to survive in this day and age, I don't think. And that whole paywall, what do you think about that? How do you think that's going to affect people into writing?
If you notice, what they're trying to do is they have to establish who they are. I think it's the Wall Street Journal makes more money than any other website.
Okay.
And the reason is because if you go to the Wall Street Journal online, you get information that you won't get anywhere else.
Can you get it in the paper? In their paper?
Not nearly as much of it.
Okay.
And the Globe is trying to do that. If when you read the Globe, you know, they have, this is what you'll get by going to our website, which you have to subscribe to. So what they're trying to do is make it, you get special information by paying a little bit for it. I don't know if it's going to work.
Yeah.
Because there are people like us who give it to you for free. So why, it has to be something special to pay money. On the other hand, if all you're paying is $1 or $2, maybe people don't care.
It's going to be very interesting to see how it works. The Sun already has instituted some policies because, you know, you look at stuff and you go to read something online and they say, oh, no, you have to subscribe to wherever. My thing is that I think that they're trying to close the gate, you know, after the horse is already gone. People are not used to paying, and nobody is the Wall Street Journal except the Wall Street Journal.
Yes.
So presumably the people that are reading the Wall Street Journal are at a certain level in terms of their lifestyle, business. So for them, it's a necessary business expense. For people who just want to read the Toronto Star, the Globe, the Sun, the whatever, they're not necessarily in the same bracket. I don't know where it's going to go.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure either.
And the other interesting thing, of course, is that just because you hang out your shingle as a writer or as a blogger doesn't necessarily mean, you know, it's very interesting when we talk about figure skating. There are some great, great bloggers out there that have great information that are accurate and that you can go to and sort of say, gee, I was thinking this. I'll see if they've talked about that as well as that other website, as well as that other website, to sort of get a picture in your mind of maybe a big story that's coming down. But there are other people who just have decided that they'd like to be near skating, horse racing, horse show jumping, whatever, and they are not necessarily trained in any way. What do you think about people who just hang out a shingle? It's that whole truth thing that I'm talking about.
I think in the new world, it actually doesn't matter what I think. It's what everyone around them thinks.
Okay.
And I think we're into a world like the world used to be a journalistic world used to be, and there are still people who do this job. There are people at the National who I have meetings with twice every day. And part of their job is to say, this story is going to be number one, this story is going to be number two, and this story is going to be number three. And I understand why they do it, but it's ridiculous.
Okay.
Because you see it all online. Everything on the National is online. They have every video online.
Right.
So you go and you say, well, that's not the National I want to watch. This is the most important story, so I'm going to choose this first.
I see.
So it's liberated the whole process because it's no longer Ken Wolf saying, here's the most important story of the day. You have to consume this first. Now you're going to a website or you're going to your mobile phone and you're just picking the story you want to read, when you want to read it, how you want to read it, and what form you want to do it. So it's changed that whole notion of top-down journalism completely. Because now it isn't top-down.
It's
people make their own decisions. Like, and again, when we started CBC.ca, I always used to say it had to exist, any website has to exist on three levels. Maybe now it's even more levels. One is for people who want everything you could possibly know. So you have to have all sorts of depth and you have to have all sorts of details. Another is for someone who wants to spend 3 or 4 minutes. And another is for, I want to spend 3 or 4 seconds.
Hmm.
But the thing about website is everyone uses it in a different way. So,
right.
And we still have journalistic arguments about what's the most important story and how you should do that story. But in reality, it doesn't really matter what I say as long as we get it available to people because people will consume it the way they want to consume it. Now, sometimes that scares the hell out of me.
Okay.
Because all they want is blood and guts.
Uh-huh.
All they want is sensational stuff. Good example from this week, you probably know all about the what's going on with the Quebec Soccer Federation not allowing people to wear turbans. The Canadian Soccer Association has said you have to, you know, get rid of those rules. You have to allow people to wear turbans. There's a lot of sexy stuff out there that people are reading. We have a soccer blogger named Ben Rycroft who's very good. And he actually provided a really smart, interesting analysis of what's going on. And what he says, it's not necessarily about the issue of turbans. It's really a fight between two bureaucratic organizations, a Canadian organization who wants to control the entire country, and a provincial organization that doesn't want to be controlled by them. And that this happens to be an issue that fits into that bigger argument.
I read that. It was about it being a microcosm.
Yeah.
See, I read it.
Great story.
Yep.
But the numbers for it are a lot less than any of the other sexier stories.
Yeah, well, of course, because it doesn't have the sort of wow factor of whoo.
Which goes to the point that if you start to react just to numbers, then it changes the type of stories you supply.
So tell me about a story, maybe closer to the beginning of your career that you covered that was huge, how you covered it, and if that same story were to happen today, how it would be covered.
The biggest one we did was Princess Diana.
Her marriage or her death?
Her death.
Okay, her 1997. Death.
That was the first big one that we did.
Now, how did you know what had happened?
Well, fortunately, we had people working. I had someone on shift who called me at, I think it was 8:30 or 9 o'clock, and then I only had one person working.
Wow.
So she just gathered wire copper and did wire copper.
So it came across the wire first.
Came across the wire first, and then we just got in that way. Now, we did a lot during the next few days, but compared that to what you would have now, like it was a different world completely. The next biggest one was 9/11, which...
2001, the internet was still a very different place from the
it was
now.
Really just taking off then. At that stage, it was, oh, this actually might be serious. We still were about third or fourth on the priority list, but people were understanding. But even then, I remember Evan Sullivan. He was one of the few people who really understood what was going on. But even the communication was so much slower then.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't get information out quickly, and it was a long process, and it was still longer form journalism. Telephone calls, we were calling people and things like that. But again, compared to now, oh, wow.
So if those two stories happen today while we're sitting here, pick one, doesn't matter. Let's say 9/11 happened right now. What happens now? In terms of the website, because now we have cbcsports.ca. Sports and news have split. Were they together at the time, or there wasn't even a cbcsports.ca?
It was a really small cbcsports.ca.
Okay, and that's now big. I mean, there are lots of people on this floor that are working there. So what would happen?
For another example, instead of going there, you might want to go to the Boston Marathon. And
perfect.
What happened
okay,
there, right?
Yep.
Because it was instant. It was Twitter. the world lit up with Twitter. The difference, and that's interesting. We actually take a backseat on a story like that on the sports site because it really becomes a news site.
Yes, okay.
Right? It becomes a news story. But the gathering of that information, first of all, you know about it instantly and the world knows about it instantly. And the weakness with that, of course, and this was illustrated very well there, is that big mistakes were made.
Okay.
Because everyone knew about it. Everyone thought they knew what was going on.
They had truth, they thought.
And they didn't have a truth. And by not having truth, they had misinformation about who was responsible, who was guilty, what was happening. And the difficulty with Twitter is one person will say it, and then 500 people retweet it.
As truth. Yeah.
And actually, there's only one person who said it, and no one questions that one person. So that I could tweet something that is sensational, that is my own point of view, but I put it in factual terms. And then someone says, wow. And then that gets retweeted, and then you retweet it, and then someone else retweets it. And suddenly, all people are doing is retweeting the tweet that was wrong without anyone doing any journalism.
But don't you find in big stories, like I'll go back to 2002, the Olympic Games, the judging scandal at the Paris. So I was there, ringside.
Yep.
So
you wrote about it.
I did write
about it. In a book, I think, that you put out, didn't you?
I did indeed. But you know what's so funny about it is that even at the time, it was my first introduction to the idea that the newspaper isn't always right. You know, so I had always taken as fact, honestly, the news. So I just, which is why actually it's very personal to me to get stories right, because I am that person who believes what comes in. So I couldn't believe when I was sitting there in Salt Lake City that the same information was getting spat out by virtually everybody. Nobody was asking the question. There was the French judge, of course, who had cheated, but there were four other judges that said that the Russian team won. Nobody ever asked those other four judges anything. Yeah. So I thought that it was kind of lazy, and I felt that there was this whole idea of people piggybacking, again, trying to get that sexy shot, that sexy story, rather than really digging deep and saying, okay, now, why would somebody vote yes and not no? Like, what are the ramifications for those other four judges? Why did they do what they did? Was it honestly what they felt, or was there pressure elsewhere? Like, I don't know. So it's that idea that there are not always people willing to do the digging, the heavy lifting. They'll just say, gee, Ken Wolf says it's right, so I'm going to go with that because I like Ken.
Yes. And a little different take on it, but it's the same thing that I was on the assignment desk at CBC News for a couple of years, and I was responsible for Quebec.
And so it's your fault.
It's my fault. Oh, man, is it ever my fault.
You shouldn't have said it that way. We love you, Quebec.
Yes, we love it. Now I am speechless twice. PJ. So there was an event happening in Montreal. There was reports that someone had been shot.
Okay.
Private media had reported it. So I'm, as the assignment editor, I have to make the call whether or not we report it.
Now, for people who don't know, what's private media? What does that mean, that term?
Anybody except for the public broadcaster. So all of the competitors to CBC. We all live in this world that we compete against each other, whether it's now you're really competing online because that's where it's happening. At that stage, we didn't have that much of an online presence. It was there, but it wasn't. As I said, it's taken a long time for it to become a priority. But you're in this position where you have to actually say to people, do we report that this person, this police officer, has died? Everyone around you has reported it. Everyone's coming to you within the building saying, can I report it? Can I report it? They've got it. Why don't we have it? So then you have to journalistically make some decisions. So in that particular case, one of our reporters on the ground said that, yes, he had been killed.
Right.
Only one, though. And journalistically, you're supposed to have two. So then we got it confirmed through Radio Canada. So we reported it. Afterwards, I got questioned about why it took so long to report this. And I just said because we didn't have double confirmation, which everyone agreed with. but I'm not sure. That's what I call journalism.
Yeah.
And you asked earlier what a journalist is. That's what a journalist does. But I'm not sure all of these other people who have the tools of being a journalist now understand that and do it.
And it's important.
Which is why there were so many problems in the Boston Marathon, is because there are people who are gathering information who don't really understand the professionalism about being a journalist.
Well, and you know, it's very important. I got approached last fall. Barbara Ann Scott died. And it got reported once, sort of like almost like a solitary tweet from somebody CTV, like in the CTV world. So I got a bunch of phone calls from a couple of different people, one from the online people saying, do you know if this is true? And I said, I don't. Let me see if I can find out from people that would know, that were reliable. It took me probably a half hour to confirm that Barbara Ann Scott had in fact died. But I didn't want to say, well, geez, if they said it, it's got to be right. You know, it's the same. I always tell the story that in the 2010 Olympics, somebody from here called me to say, we've just gotten a report that Patrick Chan was taken off the ice in a stretcher and injury and whatever. And I said, that sounds crazy. Well, can you find out? And I said, well, sure. So I, of course, hadn't happened. And within 24 hours, the same person phoned me and said, we've just gotten confirmation that Joanie Rochette's mother has died. Can you? I'm thinking, what is going on with you people making this stuff up? Well, Patrick Chan's story, not true. Joanie Rochette's story, true. So you just, you don't want to say, go with it. It'll be fine. We can, because really, once it's out there, it's out there.
But it's interesting that the process you just described, which shows your journalistic instinct.
Yes.
Because you got information on Patrick Chan and you said to yourself, that doesn't make any sense. And I'm not
but
sure.
But let me find out.
But let me find out. And I'm not sure that happens all the time now.
No, I think you're right.
Because you're going through a process, you're judging the information. Right. And when the Joanie Rochette thing, you said, that doesn't sound right, but it might be.
Let me check. So you check.
But it's this
people.
Whole process of actually receiving the information, analyzing the information, and then acting upon it in some way, which I'm not. And that's what Twitter frightens me, because I don't think that process exists as much in Twitter.
I was reading a story not long ago about, and I unfortunately cannot remember the celebrity's name, but somebody wanted to do an experiment and say that. Pick a celebrity of a certain age that they had died. So they wrote on Facebook, rest in peace, celebrity. You know, blah, blah, blah. It got liked and passed around and forwarded and all the rest of it. Well, it was just simply an experiment to see if people would accept as truth the fact that celebrity A had died. And of course they hadn't, but it was just a bit of a...
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole thing with Twitter, I had a journalism graduate who's somebody that I know, and I asked him why he had 70,000 followers. And he said, I bought them. And I said, what do you mean you bought them? And he said, because I've got, you know, over 4,000 really hard-won followers. And he said, no, you can go to a site and pay $5 and get, you know, $5, you can get 10,000 followers. And I said, well, then that kind of undermines the whole credibility in a way of someone's popularity. It's that whole smoke and mirrors thing rather than actually being something that you can qualify.
Yep.
So what was your first job out of school?
First job out of school. And you asked that question without even looking at the piece of paper. Jesus.
They're all up
PJ.
Here.
See, I'm doing this to delay.
To delay. He needs to go back to the last
you mean
century.
My first professional job out of school?
Yes. That doesn't have.
My first.
No hairnet and no hat.
No hairnet and no hat. Actually, I did a few jobs that
we
I was
all
thinking
did.
About with those. A nighttime janitor at a factory. That was a good one.
Oh, boy.
You know what? You don't want this one, but what the hell? The good thing was, like, I was cleaning up and all of this stuff, and it was at a factory in Brantford, and it was an evening shift, and the boys had lunch between 9 and 9:30. On Friday nights, there was a pub that was about 2 minutes away. They'd run out. They'd have a lot of pitchers of beer waiting on the table for them, and then they'd come back, and then guess what would always happen that I had to clean up?
They were
great
unwell.
Memories, yes. Yeah, those
honest
were
work.
Wonderful nights, honest work, which made me not want to do that type of job. First journalistic job was with Southam Business News, working on publications like shoe and leather and furniture and furnishings and
stuff
like that.
Oh, wow, okay. And then from there, how many more jobs until you came to CBC?
From there, I actually worked at CFTO, which was a really cool program called Hour Long with mm-hmm. Fraser Kelly and Isabel Bassett were the hosts. I went there as an associate producer, researcher type.
Coffee bringer.
Yeah, yeah. And what I did, which and I tell my students they should do this all the time, I hung out in the edit room and just watched them put stories together and figure out how to do that.
There's a real art to that.
Yeah, and I'm still not very good at it, but at least it gave me a brief feeling of how to put a story together. And then the producers would be go out and doing interviews, and I'd say, can I come? And I'd go, and I'd carry cable and have beers afterward with the producer, who would say, what the hell are you doing here? And then they'd tell me how you become a producer. And then they hired me as a producer.
So tell me now, there are a couple of questions. I have three more questions for you. One is, I find that many young people today, only because I gave birth to some of them, they're looking to come into a situation already ready, groomed, and at a fairly substantial salary point. So what do you tell your students at Sheridan College? What do you tell them that they need to do in order to eventually be successful?
The first thing I do when I meet them, and I guess I'm famous for this, and I say the likelihood of you getting a great job out of this are about 2%.
Okay.
And then they go, oh, shit, why am I here?
We've all said that.
What I tell journalists now is that they have to start to market and brand themselves and try to create a career for themselves that doesn't rely on an organization like the Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail or CTV or something like that.
Or CBC.
Or CBC, whoever it is, because you're not going to get that quickly. But what you have to do is you almost have to market yourself. So you have to start your own blog. You have to start your own Twitter account. You have to have a Facebook page. You have to create a brand that you sell, and you have to be really good at it.
And this is what I tell young people. You have to be willing to invest the sweat equity in yourself, and you have to love it enough that the paycheck doesn't matter.
Yeah, you have to, and you have to live it.
Yeah,
you
have to be, that's what I mean.
You have to want to do this, because if you don't want to do it, then don't even try.
Okay, next question. You were the president of an amateur sporting organization, the Mississauga Terriers. So that's hockey. How does your view of amateur sport, how has that influenced you in terms of your role here with cbcsports.ca?
Don't know.
Haven't thought of that one before, have you?
No, that's a good one.
Or maybe it hasn't, but it's just interesting.
It's really, I think I have a better grasp of, maybe not better grasp. I don't put as much emphasis on professional sports as I think as others.
Okay.
Because through the Terriers, and I think I've learned and you've learned just as a mother, the passion people have for their children and the sports that they participate in. And to me, there's so much, that is so much stronger than rooting for a professional sports team.
Okay.
So I think it helps me put professional sports into perspective. I think I'm certainly talk about it less than most of the people I work with. I know less about it because I don't really care how many home runs a right-handed first baseman has, because to me it's irrelevant. I want to know who won, but I don't get into the nitty-gritty of that because to me, and maybe this is my story sense as well, to me it's about people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about what they do. It's about emotions. It's about stories rather than stats and information like that. Like the minor hockey, it's such a fascinating world. And to see even how that has changed over the past, I guess I've been doing it for 15 years, is remarkable. Our organization was created by a man who really believed in family, that if you became a member of our organization, you should be proud of that organization and you would volunteer your time and you would help out. And you knew as when your kids played for the Terriers that you would be going, you had to give in time to do bingos. You had to give in time to volunteer at hockey tournaments and stuff like that. That isn't there anymore.
I think it needs to be brought back, to be honest.
But they won't do it.
I know.
Because if you say, actually, we don't have people go to bingos very much anymore because they now all pay our organization a certain amount of money.
To not have to.
To not have
yeah.
to. Yeah. And people will cut a check rather than volunteering their time. Even to get, like I know a couple of years ago, I was there at a hockey tournament that we help run every year. And I was there just sort of to make sure everything went okay. And then we had three volunteers who had agreed to volunteer. But their team had been moved to another rink.
Mm-hmm.
They all left.
Hmm.
Leaving me, the volunteer, who has no connections whatsoever, doing everything that they were supposed to be doing. And they didn't care.
You know, it's so interesting. I still coach figure skating, yeah. and our figure skating club, like all the others, relies on a volunteer board. And in the course of my career, started in Mississauga, didn't start, I spent a long time in Mississauga as well. But in the course of my career, I have gone toe-to-toe with a number of mothers who have talked to me about how busy they are. And I say, hold up, single mother of three, also working around the clock. Don't tell me how busy you are, at home lady. I want you with the nanny. Man up, lady, pull on the big girl panties and away you go, because you're not going to be able to out-busy me. Trust me. And I have had to volunteer all over the place with different people, right?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes people see not volunteering as a way to show that they're somehow special and unique, and their situation is special and unique. And my thing is, children learn by example. And it doesn't matter how busy you are, if you're supposed to bring the cupcakes in for the bake sale, bring in the cupcakes for the bake sale.
Actually, I was going to a hockey meeting a little while ago, and I was listening to...
When you bailed on me for the other
when
podcast
When I bailed
time?
On you
yeah,
yeah,
okay,
the other time,
it.
Yep. I actually can't remember what... Oh, it was a repeat of the morning show.
Okay.
And the topic came up, and it sounded like one of these academics droning on.
Grinders.
Like, do I have to really? And I'm about to hit the button, and then he started to talk about... I listened to what they said, and it was a study that had been done about daycares. And daycares, as you probably know, they charge extra money if you're late.
Yeah, like 10 bucks a minute or something.
Something like that.
Yep.
I think it was less than that is what this... So they did a study on this, and what one of the daycares did was they were having real problems because everyone was showing up late, and they said, this is a real considerable problem for us. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to increase the fine. So that will motivate people because they don't want to pay money to come and be here on time. The result was actually the opposite.
Wow.
Because people were more willing to pay because they had put in this decision. It had become a monetary arrangement now between the parents and the daycare center. And before that, you could actually, it was an emotional arrangement and they felt guilty. But once they put that monetary...
The
price tag to it, people came later than ever before.
Wow.
Because they said, well, I pay for this now.
So interesting.
So that's what, and I thought of that as I was going to the hockey meeting and talked a lot about it, because it seems to me that's what we've done with...
We've given people an out.
And
the
they
out
would
is
rather
with the checkbook.
Pay. Right. Yeah. And so they just write checks.
You know, it's fascinating to sort of watch and see how people do things. Okay, here's the biggie. I've been working all 45 minutes of this now.
45 minutes. It just goes so quickly with you, PJ.
I know. I want to know your three best qualities that makes you the journalist, the career guy, the whatever that you are today. And then I want you to describe for me what the Ken Wolfe of 20 years from now has to have in order to do your job. Like, how is your job going to evolve and what is that person going to need? May still be you in 20 years. With the walker.
With the walker.
So the three best qualities today.
True. As a journalist? Oh, well, one of them is experience. So that's good, actually. I think that. I think another one is I'm pretty calm.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm not one quick to judgment. So I'm quite willing to wait, to relax, and let's not hurry into this. And I think the other one is that I'm actually... some people may call this boring, but I don't get really passionate about one side or the other because I'm always look for what I think is the honest solution or situation, because I don't, I guess, and this is part of, I guess, an experience that I've learned enough over time is that there are always two sides to every story. And if you think you've got it nailed, that this is exactly what happened, you're wrong.
And then there's the truth.
And where the hell is the truth? Sometimes I don't know, but I know that if I talk, here's where it appears to me to be going on, but you could look at the same information and come to a different conclusion. And I think that's what, as a journalist, you have to do, is that you are always part of the story because you hear things differently than other people do. But what you have to do is keep an open mind and understand that there are other points of view and listen and try to figure out what that point of view is. And sometimes you will make a judgment on that, but you have to always be willing to listen to the other side.
You know, I'll give you one quick thing. I was talking to the late, great Randy Starkman at a skating event, and we were sitting in a row of writers watching figure skating, and I was helping some of the other writers figure out sort of what jumps had happened and whatever, and giving people some points that were important, I felt, in skating. Randy took me aside and he said, "Why are you doing that? Why are you giving other people information?" And I said, "Well, a couple of reasons. One, I want them to get it right. I mean, it would be the fact that it's skating and I know a lot about it and it matters to me. I want them to get it right. But B, it doesn't really matter what the information is. They don't have what's inside my head. They don't have what's inside your head. We can all have exactly the same information and it will come out differently on paper because of who we are and what we bring to it."
Yeah, and just I'll go back to where we started with Peter Zosky. What you used to do with Peter is, and I remember I produced an interview with Wayne Gretzky for him. And I spent,
he's hockey, right?
He's Kidding. Hockey. And I'm from Brantford. And I always tell that. Here's the story I always tell. It's completely wrong, but it starts conversations. That my dad taught Walter how to make an outdoor rink.
Did he really?
No. Oh. That's a great story.
There's that truth in journalism we were looking for.
It's a great story. Now, where the hell was it going?
You be Peter Zosky. We were talking
about.
Well, we were talking about the fact that I said to Randy, it doesn't matter who has the information, what comes out.
When I did this interview with Gretzky, and I worked really hard on the preparation and stuff, Peter would actually read it, and then he would process it. And then he would take it into places I had never thought it could go.
Mm.
But it always felt like my interview.
Isn't that something?
Like he used to say, "Argue with me in your research." He said, "I may disagree, but then I know
where to go
and how I'm going to refute that argument." So it's this whole notion that, yes, people have the same information, but they use it in different ways. So your other thing, what would someone who's doing my job in 20 years be like?
Yep.
Man, they're going to be wired. And I mean that they're going to be on Twitter. They're going to have sources of information all the time. The modern journalist now, in many ways, curates information rather than creates information, that they're just going to have information coming all the time. How they're going to process it, I'm not sure. And I'm not sure how much creation of new information there will be. And that worries me.
Hmm.
And I think there will be just, it's going to be a process of getting it out. Now, it may be a process of getting it out in different ways than we've even thought about now.
Well, you know what? I couldn't imagine us being here today doing this, even just starting 6 years ago. Who would have thunk we'd be sitting in a room, locked in a room, actually. Dan, let us out.
Yes. Please.
Ken Wolf, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been most informative and was exactly what I was looking for. Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting about the interview is just that we have immediate access. Like, we know what's going on all over the world, really, through all of these different mediums. But sometimes it can be miscommunication and it can only sort of confuse things a little bit.
Well, it's kind of like broken telephone. I mean, when you think about, all over the news at the time of the Arab Spring, they were talking about how information was being forwarded by Twitter and by other social media platforms to the people who were actually involved, not only the people outside of the Arab world who were observing. So, you know, you have to kind of... Yeah, for me, I look at Twitter, and if I see something that goes through on Twitter, I will take it as kind of like a heads up, but it doesn't mean that I don't call or go or try and find out for sure.
Well, the first time that really I realized how important all this stuff was getting, I actually, a few years ago, when there was the G20 meeting here in Toronto, I went downtown. I don't really know
even
why.
Even though I told you not to.
But I was following, like, you could follow what was going on, and I was actually, you would be getting tweets saying, don't go to this street,
location,
don't turn
yeah.
here, or there's sort of rioters coming down the street this way. It was pretty wild that you're there and you're sort of following what was going on, and it was just sort of a steady stream of information of what was like actually happening in the moment. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, the whole firsthand account. Well, it's just when Ken was talking about Princess Diana and her death, you know, being one of the first big stories that they had on the web, they still had to access a human being
yeah.
in order to get the information, as someone that they knew. So now you can just put a question out there on Twitter, and you will get responses. On Facebook, on even YouTube, you can put contests on YouTube, and next thing you know, you've got all kinds of people who are strangers to you. So I like the fact that it connects everybody, but just because it connects everybody doesn't necessarily mean that you trust everybody that you meet.
Mm-hmm.
So buyer beware is kind of the lesson from this. And Ken Wolf, great opportunity to speak to somebody who is so well-versed on the subject of media, so I really enjoyed it.
That's great, and you can find us on Twitter.
Yes.
At Open Kwong Door. Search us on Facebook, and email us at contact@openkwongdoor.com, and on the website, openkwongdoor.com. That's it.